Hello and welcome to Media Geek. This is your weekly look at the world of grassroots and independent media, as well as a critical examination of our media environment. My name is Paul Riesmandel, and I'm your host on today's program, how residents of Detroit are telling their own story through independent media. I'll be bringing you audio from a session held at the Allied Media Conference 2006, featuring Catherine Kelly from the Michigan Citizen newspaper and Ron Scott, who's with the Detroit Coalition Against Police Brutality. And also, it was a big week at the Senate Commerce Committee, and they voted not so good internet freedom, but gave a little boost to low-power radio. I'll give a wrap-up on that on today's Media Geek. So the weekend just passed for here at Airtime. Back at June 23 through the 25th, I attended once again the Allied Media Conference in Bowling Green, Ohio. It was, I believe, my fifth time there, and it was the seventh conference overall, and will actually be the last conference held in Bowling Green, which is just a little bit south of Toledo in northwest Ohio, the home of Bowling Green State University. Because next year, for 2007, the conference plans to move to the city of Detroit. And there's a lot of participation from people making independent media in Detroit for this conference, which brings together independent media makers and art makers from all across North America and beyond. Tries to bring people together so strategies can be exchanged, stories can be exchanged, people can learn things and pick up new skills and meet new people. It's always a great conference, and I had a great time. And one of the best sessions I went to was about the city of Detroit and the independent media going on strong there. Last year, I went to a session, a similar one, that painted the history of independent media in Detroit, specifically how that history sort of coalesced with the Black Power movement of the late 60s and the early 70s. The session this year really concentrated on what people are doing now to bring independent voices and to the people of Detroit and the larger area in Michigan there. And as sort of the rundown of the of this particular session, the description goes, representations of Detroit in corporate media rarely stray from the master narratives of urban disaster or the heroism of corporate-led revitalization. These dominant narratives help maintain a stranglehold on perceptions of reality in Detroit and limit the possibility of change in the city. Independent media plays a crucial role in countering that narrative, with the struggles for justice, self-determination, and transformation brewing beneath the surface. It's a tension in many of our communities, but Detroit's history and proximity to the Allied Media Conference make it a particularly good case study. This panel will look at the legacies of independent media working to advance social movements in Detroit, as well as current projects and visions for the future. So the first person we're going to listen to is Catherine Kelly, who is a publisher behind the newspaper called The Michigan Citizen.
My name is Catherine Kelly. I'm from the Michigan Citizen newspaper. thank you, Lena. my parents actually founded the paper, and so that's a very nice introduction. They founded the paper on our dining room table in 1978, and they founded the paper in a very impoverished community, Benton Harbor, Michigan, and they really believe it is often impoverished people who don't have a voice or a perspective in media, so it became something that they really took on with the paper. My father passed away in February, so, you know, as you talked a little bit about legacy, you know, it's kind of, you know, part of our work is just continuing what we've done. And in Detroit, the context of Detroit with working in such a corporate media environment, it can be pretty challenging, but I just always try to remember some of the things that, you know, my parents always talked about, you know, giving good information to people so that they can make good decisions. And when you have corporate media kind of creating, controlling the discussion, the level of discussion, inventing issues, inventing perspectives, inventing ways to to misinform people, it becomes very, very important that people who don't often have voice, that they have a place to go, and that's what we will always, what the Michigan citizen will always be.
I guess specifically with the Michigan citizen, how do the stories that are, you know, featured on the pages of the Citizen, which really range from everything from, you know, the student walkouts in McKenzie High School that, you know, weren't talked about in mainstream media, or, you know, the water crises in Highland Park, how do those stories get solicited? What's the level of community involvement?
Well, we're very much in the community, and our editorial approach in terms of covering stories, we're not a paper that goes to the press conference to get the story. We actually avoid press conferences. We avoid them. We send reporters to community meetings. We believe the stories and the perspective comes out of the community. I was trying to think of an example of a story that we covered. There are lots that we covered that have actually, from the elected school board and school takeover, like you said, to the water issue, the student walkout at McKenzie. But I wanted to talk a little bit about the Detroit Zoo story, because I think that's a story that actually, it's kind of fun to talk about. Because of what happened in Detroit around the zoo story, I think it's a good example of kind of what happens in the city of Detroit around corporate media and independent media. You have such a economically and racially segregated city and metro area when it comes to Detroit. And in earlier this year, there was a huge, it became evident that the city of Detroit had to do something with the zoo, and the Detroit Zoological Society, which is a kind of private nonprofit, wanted to take over the zoo. And the city council, you know, they had some questions about that. And the mainstream media reported this, and they got on the board with this issue, like, save the zoo. Don't close the zoo. You know, we have to have a zoo. We had news reporters in fur coats sending petitions around to keep the zoo open. Because there's always this misconception that the leadership, which is African-American, mostly African-American in the city of Detroit, can't lead. There's always that question, you know, that question, can black folks really run a city? What decisions do they make? How crazy are the decisions? And so the Detroit Zoo and the mainstream media took on this insane energy on save the zoo. How can these people in the city, these city leaders, decide that we don't need a zoo? And no one really talked about the zoo issue from the perspective of Detroit City residents, where Detroit City residents had already suffered the closing of a zoo on Belle Isle. We had we are up against the intense loss. We're looking at the intense loss of city services. So the zoo for us was like, how come all these crazy people are, you know, banging this drum about save the zoo, save the zoo? And it just didn't resonate for Detroiters. So we kind of just talked about that a little bit. You know, we live in one of the poorest cities in the country, and we have a group of people who want to, you know, take their kids to the zoo, and there was no acknowledgement of the different perspective. I mean, you know, let alone even a question of, should animals even be in a zoo? Like, you know, there's just no consideration of perspective and different perspectives in the city of Detroit. And at the paper, that's just something that we always try to do. Like even the McKenzie walkout, Detroit Public Schools, and around that time, the police department, they were making additional moves to criminalize kids, to not just criminalize kids, but to criminalize the parents, to ticket the parents of the children who walked out of the school. And, you know, we were kind of the only paper that said, wait, do kids have a voice? Do kids have the right to protest their surroundings, their environment? Can they practice civil disobedience? You know, what are their rights in this? And what happens in communities where, kids walking out, when you have kids walking out of school and their parents are ticketed in an already an impoverished community, what does that mean?
And that was Catherine Kelly, the publisher behind Michigan Citizen, a newspaper in the Detroit area, talking about the role of her paper and her paper's reportage in the city and area of Detroit. And you are listening to Media Geek, your weekly look at the world of grassroots and independent media, as well as a critical examination of our media environment. I'm your host, Paul Reese-Mandel. If you have any comments about the program, send them to me, paul@mediageek.net. And you can download the program at radio.mediageek.net. You can also download the entirety, all the audio from that session at radio.mediageek.net, as well as I've got links to some other audio that was recorded from other sessions held at the Allied Media Conference 2006, which happened June 23rd through 25th in Bowling Green, Ohio. And that audio from Catherine Kelly is part of a session from the Allied Media Conference called Representing Detroit, Telling Our Own Story Through Independent Media. I'm going to continue with a little bit more audio from that session, and now we're going to hear from Ron Scott, who's with the Detroit Coalition Against Police Brutality, but a media maker himself. First, you will hear moderator of the session, Jenny Lee, with the organization behind Detroit Summer, who will give a little background and pose questions to Ron Scott.
Talking about, you know, why this panel, why talking about Detroit at this conference, the theme of which is, you know, being right is not enough, and independent media in connection to movements for social justice and community organizing. So if you could tell us a little bit about how your work as a media producer relates to and is connected to community organizing.
That's a big and a small thing. Essentially, you know, for most of my life, I've been doing some things that have been related to organizing. And I think if those of you have looked at the resume, then you know that I've been an activist, really. In fact, I was just joking about it, probably since I was in the kindergarten when I opposed the manner in which we were forced to adhere to some of the policies then. So I was ejected and put out of kindergarten. So, and I went back and talked to a lot of activists, and I find out that over the years that much of what you become and who you are is obviously centered and related to via your culture. And a lot of people who have become activists have done it very early in life. And so for my lifetime, that's pretty much been the focus. I always relate to media for me as being a vocation, and really activism as being, or shall I say the other way around, is that activism is a vocation and media is an avocation. I've used essentially the skills that I've garnered both professionally in media as a producer, as on-air personality, DJ, all of those kinds of things. I've used that to basically act as a tool, some cases as a weapon, to provide information and to promote social activism. So within that context, I've worked, did a show a long time ago called Black Journal. It was on PBS. And after a 5.5-year run with the show, we're doing everybody from essentially focuses on Malcolm X, the Black Panther Party, fighting the Nazis, whatever. I was fired from the show, and that was part of the process that began what you now are dealing with some 20, 30 years later, which was motivated by the desire of the right in this country to quell and control public broadcasting, because it was seen as the bastion of radicalism, and to some degree it was. But the Reagan administration, some of the corporate entities that were supporting public television have now gotten to the point where public television and public television producers are being challenged to present both sides of an issue, quote unquote, whatever those both sides are. But they began to develop very tactical maneuvers to strategically fire people who were doing progressive media. I happen to be one of those people who were caught in that mix. People in the community organized, dealt with it. You'll find it happening. It happened on radio, television, and so on. So for the last 20, 25 years, I've been doing things independent of that. The most recent is with the Detroit Coalition Against Police Brutality. We just finished a show this morning called Fighting for Justice. In the capacity of producing and hosting that program, we focused on a number of particular activities which we've organized around. Most recently, we've been organizing in relationship to the homeless. Homeless people have come under attack. They came under attack during the time of the Super Bowl, and it happened in other cities. It happened in Jacksonville when the Super Bowl was held there and so on. The idea was to sweep the homeless, and I hope you would include this in your lexicon as opposed to homeless. We've been referring to the homeless as displaced workers because they would work if they could work. They've been displaced by the current and former economic policies that exist. So therefore, people who have skills have been displaced. Also, individuals who've been displaced, as in Michigan and some other places, because of their social, economic, and medical station in life. Some people who were like mentally ill were literally kicked out of the mental institutions by former Governor England. So we moved to organize them when one of the homeless or displaced worker, a guy by the name of Eric Williams that they referred to as Mr. Magoo, who was schizophrenic, was shot by a state trooper, was shot with his pants at his knees. He was shot in the chest and subsequently was acquitted by a jury that was not of his peers, was acquitted when it was actually on video. In fact, it was really kind of interesting that Detroit police officers testified against the state troopers that he was shot, murdered. And during the time, we had occasion on our program, on a blog that I do, and on another show that I do called For My People, to challenge people to begin to organize about this. In the Coalition Against Police Brutality, we've organized with families, we organized with his families, and so on. And it's a continuing battle. Most recently, homeless people in that same area of Detroit near the Greektown Casino have been attacked, jumped on, kicked, beaten by private security forces. We've organized the displaced workers. We're negotiating with the Greektown merchants now to resolve that issue, but we feel that ultimately what's going to have to happen, and we've developed so much response from it via our program, via newspapers like The Citizen and others, until what's happened now is that we may very soon have to have a major demonstration. But the media, the emphasis that we placed on it, and the Coalition Against Police Brutality the last 10 years, media and the uses of it strategically have aided really immeasurably in the mobilizing of people, in the education of folks, and in making it the understanding that police brutality is not simply where the nightstick hits the head, but where the corporation hits you everywhere.
And that was Ron Scott from the Detroit Coalition Against Brutality, speaking at the Allied Media Conference on June 25th. In Bowling Green, Ohio, and as part of a session called Representing Detroit, Telling Our Own Story Through Independent Media. You can learn more about the conference at alliedmediaconference.org. You can get the full audio from that particular session at radio.mediageek.net. And this is Media Geek. So, on the 28th of June, the Senate Commerce Committee finally passed through its big telecom so-called reform bill. This is the bill. It is sort of the analog of the COPE Act in the House, which is intended to create a national franchise for cable television. The purpose of this is to speed the entry of large telephone companies like AT&T and Verizon into the cable television market, offering cable TV services over their broadband internet lines, but not making them heed the obligation of their cable competitors. They will not, therefore, have to negotiate individually with individual municipalities, cities, and communities for the right to use public right-of-way in order to provide this service. Instead, there would be just a standard national contract where they would pay a standardized fee to every single community to begin rolling out this service and would not have to be obligated to allow the same requirements that cable TV is obligated. One of the things in the Senate bill that the large cell phone companies would not be obligated to do is to provide service equally to all parts of communities. In effect, that would allow them to redline, to offer only service to the wealthier parts of municipalities and not be obligated to provide service to less wealthy parts. In essence, meaning that people living in the wealthy part of a city could have many different cable companies to choose from and lots of competitive competition on pricing, competition on services, whereas poorer residents would still just have possibly one, the remaining and previous traditional cable TV service. This seems to be a bad deal for public access TV, which is usually funded out of the monies paid by cable television services to local communities. It will make it more difficult for communities to negotiate, if it passes, for things like cable access, educational channels, and so on. In exchange, guardians of the public interest have been trying to get senators and House members to put in other requirements on the telephone companies and on information providers to service the public interest. The big one has been net neutrality, which I've been talking about for pretty much the entire year here, 2006. And there was indeed an amendment offered to provide network neutrality as part of this bill. So then in exchange for getting this national franchise, the large telephone operators would be obligated never to discriminate against content, nor to discriminate against the type of content. So they would not be able to slow down other types of video on the internet in favor of their own video content. And it failed by a pretty much partisan vote of 11 to 11, with 11 out of 12 Republicans on the Senate Commerce Committee voting against. Only Republican Olympia Snow voted for. All 10 Democrats voting on that amendment voted in favor of it. There was also an amendment to expand low-power FM. That, in fact, succeeded, 14 to 11. That particular bill, which we spoke about on the program last week, offered by Senator John McCain, who voted against network neutrality, would restore low-power FM to the original standard set by the FCC back in 2000, which was then cut back by Congress. And if it were to become law, we would be able to see many more low-power FM stations put on the dial, especially in large metropolitan areas where they currently cannot be put on the dial because 10 and 100-watt stations are being forced to accept the same spacing requirements as 10,000 and 100,000-watt stations. But another bad thing that passed in this bill is the broadcast flag. The broadcast flag would require electronics manufacturers to give the ability to turn off your record button to the entertainment industry, such that the movie industry, the television industry, the music industry would be able to embed a signal in radio and television such that you could not record something. Even if you had the legal right to do so, they would be able to turn that off. And the ability to implement such a thing was passed by the Senate Commerce Committee. But that law isn't going anywhere right now, this particular Telecom Act. And that's because Senator Ron Wyden, a Democrat from Oregon, put a hold on the bill. That is the privilege of any senator to put a hold on a bill pretty much for any reason. And his particular reason is because they failed to put network neutrality, because a network neutrality amendment failed to be placed into this bill. And in fact, the chair of the Senate Commerce Committee, Senator Ted Stevens of Alaska, admitted to the press this week that he doesn't think that the bill could be brought out of debate to begin with. Meaning if Democratic senators were to choose to filibuster it while debate goes on the floor, he doesn't think he has enough votes in the Senate to kill the filibuster. So pretty much the so-called telecom reform bill is sitting and waiting for the Senate to figure out what it wants to do, which may require Senate Republicans to come to the table and negotiate over things like network neutrality, which seems to be the big issue. And the things that might have to be given on include things like expanding low-power FM and things like the broadcast flag. This is really going to be a really rough negotiation when it comes to public interest, because there's so many things to this bill, like the broadcast flag, like the national franchise, which are generally bad for the public interest, which hand over lots and lots to the telecom industry and not very much to the public. So it's going to be a real horse trading session as Senate Democrats and other people in the media reform movement try to figure out what it is they're willing to give in order to get something. My guess is that net neutrality is going to be at the top of that list, that if there is going to be a bill that gets passed, network neutrality is going to have to be the big thing that gets put into it in order for at least the Senate to pass it. Of course, then it goes into conference in order to put together the House bill, which contains no network neutrality provisions, and make it work out with the Senate bill. And who knows how that might go. In fact, in many ways, for a lot of people, it may very well be the best thing that this bill goes nowhere. So the national franchise does not get created, and so net neutrality doesn't get put into law either. But it seems that it's probably not quite as important, or isn't quite something we need right away if the big telephone companies don't otherwise have the incentive to cut back your ability to get video on the internet, because they're also offering competing for-pay video service on the internet, and network neutrality would still have the opportunity to be passed as a bill on its own. So it's going to be an interesting month coming up here in the Senate as they try and figure out how to pass their so-called telecom reform bill, create a national franchise, or possibly put into action network neutrality and guarantee internet freedom. And I'm sure that many of them would like to do this before the end of their session and before election season. But it remains to see whether or not that can happen. Keep looking at MediaGeek website, MediaGeek.net, to find out what's going on. Also go to SaveTheInternet.com. to learn more about this struggle over the future of our media, which is the future of the internet. And that brings me to a close of this edition of Media Geek. I'll be back in 1 week with more news of our media environment. The plan for next week is to talk a bit about audio recording. So people are podcasting, and I think, in my opinion, we're getting into almost a golden age of the ability to have inexpensive, high-quality audio recording tools available to lots of people. So we'll talk a little bit about what's out there and what's it's useful for and what you can do with it. That'll be the main topic of Media Geek next week, and I'm sure I'll have more news about network neutrality and all the hijinks going on in Washington, D.C. That brings to a close another edition of Media Geek. I'm your host and producer, Paul Riesmandel, and I'll be back in 1 week with more news about grassroots and independent media, as well as our media environment. In the meantime, check out Media Geek online at MediaGeek.net, where you'll find the Media Geek blog with frequently updated news and views about our media. You can also download the program at Radio.MediaGeek.net or subscribe to the podcast to have it automatically downloaded to your computer or MP3 player. That's all at MediaGeek.net. The closing music is Fire in the Sky by Adam Lowe. Media Geek is produced live at Community Radio WEFT in Champaign, Illinois. Some segments are pre-recorded at Media Geek Studios. And Media Geek is heard on 9 other community stations around North America, including KRFP in Moscow, Idaho, KQRP in Salida, California, KRBS in Oroville, California, WSLR in Sarasota, Florida, WTND in Macomb, Illinois, WRFA in Jamestown, New York, WYQZ in Warrenton-Bealeton, Virginia, CKDU in Halifax, Nova Scotia, and Free Radio Olympia in Olympia, Washington. Media Geek is free to air on your local community radio station, too. Just drop me a line at paul@mediageek.org. That email address is also good for any comments you want to send in about the program. Once again, that's paul@mediageek.org. Thanks for tuning in.